In our first story, Behind Mansion Walls,
he found a scene of just untold gruesomeness.
A life rich with promise, a night soaked in blood.
Nobody in his dorm saw him that night. Nobody.
And later,
they were a very affluent, socially successful and popular couple.
The splendor of success.
It's a friend.
And the specter of greed.
The only way out was money. The only way to get it was to kill.
I'm Christopher Mason. The ranks of the rich are awash with cheap imitations. Strutting peacocks whose bespoke suits are borrowed, their Bentleys belong to the bank. They've cheated their way into the affluent inner circle, and they'll sell their own mother to stay there, hiding their true nature behind a mask of lies.
November morning, a man rises early to prepare for work.
He's trying to do his morning routine. He walked around the kitchen, opened up the refrigerator.
He seemed to be on autopilot, going through his morning motions.
But suddenly, that routine comes to a halt.
He just fell face down into the stairs.
What's wrong with him? And what just happened upstairs?
This horrifying sight. Up on the ceiling, on the walls, everywhere I looked, it was just blood.
There was an axe murderer on the loose in Delmar.
In 2003, proud parents Joan and Peter Porco have plenty to celebrate.
Joan and Peter were both very successful. They held themselves up to the highest standards, and so they expected that their children would do the same.
Great start.
Today, youngest son Christopher is the toast of his family.
Cheers.
Cheers, son. I'm so proud.
Christopher Porco and been accepted at the University of Rochester in central New York. And it's a very good school.
Older brother Jonathan has a promising career in the Navy. Christopher hopes to emulate his success.
The last one, finally good to go.
At Rochester,
hey,
Christopher makes a big impression on his fellow students.
At college, he was very popular. He was part of a fraternity. He was a swimming champion.
And Christopher's popularity is boosted by his habit of splashing the cash.
Chris would go out and buy a whole bunch of pizzas and beers, you know, bring them in and give them to everybody.
From his first day on campus, Christopher's boasted of his family's wealth. He's heir to his grandmother's fortune worth $2.8 million. He helps broker lucrative investment deals. His dad's a powerful attorney. And his family has a holiday mansion on the Outer Banks.
He was someone who was financially successful from outward appearances. He drove this souped-up Jeep, very fancy. He basically lived this lavish lifestyle. Many people thought he was from a very, very well-to-do family.
Then, on November 15th, 2004, Christopher's life changes.
Hello? What?
An intern within the local newspaper of record had called to ask him if he had any thoughts or had anything to say because his parents had both been attacked.
When? How?
Earlier that day, Detective Chris Bowdish had been called to the Porco home in Delmar, New York. A co-worker of Peter Porco had called police, and he sounded distressed.
He said he had come there that morning to see if Peter Porco was okay because he didn't show up for work that morning.
Police enter the home and find Peter Porco lying at the foot of the staircase.
Tip upstairs.
Okay.
When I first looked at Peter, I saw these very huge hack marks in his forehead, across his forehead, and they were deep into his skull. They were just horrific gash marks, which I found out later were made by an axe.
Peter has dripped blood all over the house. It's the most perplexing crime scene these cops have ever seen. The only explanation for it? A bizarre brain malfunction caused by Peter's injuries.
Peter had actually been walking around in this almost unconscious state, not realizing perhaps the extent of his injuries. At least one of those gashes went so deep, it actually went into Peter's brain. But it didn't apparently hit the part that affects what we all do really on instinct. So that is perhaps why he was doing those instinctual morning routine items.
Now, 52-year-old Peter is dead. But he's not the only victim.
At that point, I had one of my officers that went upstairs call to me and said, I have somebody alive up here.
He found a scene of just untold gruesomeness.
It was this horrifying sight of this totally blood-soaked woman.
It's Joan Porco, her head also cleaved with an axe.
She was literally, in my feeling, hanging on, you know, just to stay alive.
Believing Joan is just moments from death, Detective Bowditch makes a snap decision.
I said to her, do you understand me? Can you hear me?
Joan, can you hear me?
And she nodded her head, yes.
Bowditch thinks fast. Downstairs, there's no sign of burglary or forced entry. And a spare key appeared to have been used to access the house. He's got a hunch Peter and Joan have been attacked by someone they knew.
Did a family member do this to you?
And she shook her head, yes.
They were able to call out quickly, find the name of the sons.
Bowditch learns the Porco boys are 21-year-old Christopher and 23-year-old Jonathan.
Did Jonathan do this?
She shook her head, no, very definitely no. And then I did say to her, did Christopher do this?
Did Christopher do this?
And she shook her head yes. Again, no doubt about it, she shook her head yes.
Police believe the damning declaration is the final act of a dying woman.
I honestly thought she was going to expire.
She wasn't supposed to survive.
But Joan Porco will defy the odds. And when she wakes up, everything will change.
The dying declaration is a staple of mystery novels. Those final whispered words when a victim names their attacker. But could that happen in the real world? The answer is yes. And like the best thrillers, this story comes with a twist.
On November 15th, 2004, Joan Porco is discovered barely alive. Her husband, Peter, is downstairs dead. Both have been attacked with an axe.
This scene was so horrific, and it was just so unbelievably bad that this was the worst scene I've ever been in.
Before she's loaded into an ambulance, Joan indicates to police she knows who did it. Her youngest son, Christopher. But now, as Joan lies in a coma, Christopher is rushed to her bedside. Could his mom be mistaken?
Everyone in our readership area just couldn't get enough of this story. You know, it was a murder mystery, you know, kind of unfolding right before our eyes.
No one is closer to that unfolding story than reporter Brendan Lyons. While other media were banned from the hospital, he had full access thanks to a remarkable coincidence. His wife was giving birth there.
It was my fourth child, and we were on an upper floor above where they were in the intensive care unit. I used to make excuses that I was going down the cafeteria, and I could go down and sit in the waiting area where the Porco relatives and friends were gathered.
At the crime scene, Joan had indicated her son Christopher carried out the attack.
The suspect early on in her murder had access to her bedside, and not many murder suspects have that access. And I think even the police were concerned genuinely that he might try to suffocate her.
Detective Chris Bowdish keeps a close eye on his prime suspect.
All this while, I'm thinking, God, is this the guy who actually did this? This horrific act that I saw in his house that day?
But is it? All Bowdish has to go on is the declaration of a woman who seemed near death. Is her son really the killer?
Christopher, can I ask you a few questions?
At one point, I said to him, your mother said you did it.
I don't believe you. Cops lie.
And without even shaking, he just looked at me and he said, you're lying. Police lie, just like that to me.
Like I said, cops lie.
I need you to come down to the station.
When questioned at Bethlehem Police Station, Christopher claims he spent the entire weekend on campus at Rochester, 230 miles from where the crime was committed.
He indicated to me that he was in the lounge of where his dorm was the whole night. He had been watching movies with his dorm mates there in the fraternity, and pretty much, I think he said he slept on the couch that night.
He kept telling them, well, I don't know what you're trying to get here, but I couldn't have done this. I was away at college, several hours away.
Detectives are dispatched to Rochester, where it emerges Christopher's alibi is far from ironclad.
They called me the next morning, and they said to me, nobody in this dorm saw him that night. Nobody.
Christopher seems to have been untruthful about other things, too. That home on the Outer Banks he bragged about doesn't exist. The investment deal he told friends about never happened. He's not a rich heir. He's a kid from the Del Mar suburbs, with a dad who's a law clerk and a mom who's a speech therapist.
The image I got was of a young man who the pressure of hiding a fake life, all of it was starting to crumble.
Christopher has no solid alibi and told a slew of lies. Cops anticipate an open and shut case. All they need is the only eyewitness to testify, Christopher's mom.
Joan Porco, after a period of time, was able to talk.
And what she says will place the investigation back at square one.
She indicated that she didn't recall what had happened and that she doesn't think her son did it.
You don't remember who attacked you?
No, I don't remember anything.
You don't remember telling me that Christopher did this?
No, I didn't say that.
Suddenly, the case against Christopher is crumbling.
I have a problem now because now the mother who was attacked by what I thought was her son, was now saying that she didn't remember and she didn't think it was her son.
Many people thought that maybe they got the wrong person at that point.
No.
Could it be that Christopher's just a liar and not a killer?
Christopher had no history of violence that we knew of in his past. Certainly never been arrested for any violent incidents.
The more cops dig, the more suspects step out of the shadows. Cops especially want to speak to the owner of a mysterious fingerprint found at the crime scene.
I developed that fingerprint and pulled it. That fingerprint ended up being a subject of conversation because we were never able to find the person who owned that print.
Then police discover something few people knew: the Porco family's ties to organized crime.
a rumor of some gang involvement through an uncle of Peter's that apparently had been part of a crime family down in New York City for a few years. He was a retired fireman. They called him Frankie the Fireman.
The rumor mill speculates that Frankie the Fireman might be a snitch and that the Porcos have been attacked in retaliation.
If he gave up some information that might be valuable, some people might not be very happy with that. And to send a message, Peter Porco might have been attacked as a way to get back at the snitch.
It also emerges that Peter Porco had received threats against his life.
Peter Porco had worked in family law cases. One of the possible leads that was brought up was that there was someone who had basically threatened the Porcos years ago, saying that he was going to kill the judge on the case as well as Peter Porco and another man who worked on that case. And we're wondering if he might have perhaps come back and done this.
Organized crime, previous death threats, the list of suspects is mounting. Until the moment cops examine the records of a smashed alarm system at the Porco home.
It showed that at 2:14 a.m. in the morning, the house master code was put into that alarm to shut it off.
And there were only so many people who knew of that master code.
Christopher Porco is one of them. Yet he maintains he was over 230 miles away, sleeping innocently on the couch at his frat house. He didn't have time to drive to Del Mar, attack his parents with an axe, then drive back to Rochester. Or did he?
Campus security cameras caught this Jeep both leaving and then coming back early the next morning.
In November 2004, Peter Porco is hacked to death with an axe in his own home. His wife Joan is also attacked and left for dead.
In my mind, whoever did this was absolutely horrifically, you know, just a savage that did it. You know, no feeling whatsoever.
Detectives follow a wide spectrum of leads, a gangland connection.
It seemed too amateurish in some ways for a mob hit.
The disgruntled husband of one of Peter's clients.
It later turned out through testimony that this man was in Virginia at the time and had swiped in for work early that morning, so it would have been impossible for him to have come and committed the murder.
Then, CCTV footage offers an irrefutable breakthrough. Christopher Porco, the son of Peter and Joan, tells police he was asleep 230 miles away on the night of the murder. So why is his distinctive yellow Jeep captured leaving his college campus? And why does a neighbor say he later saw it parked in the Porco's driveway?
So he says, I know this Jeep. And he says, that Jeep was sitting in that driveway at 4 a.m.
From records stored by the home alarm system, detectives know the murder happened between 2:14 a.m. and 4:59 a.m.
And that Jeep sitting in the driveway at 4 a.m., it's looking more and more like it could be Chris Porco.
Christopher's mask of lies begins to slip. Behind it, cops see a fraud who is flunking college and almost $40,000 in debt. He's faked his dad's signature to obtain loans, and his parents are wising up.
He had stolen from them, he had stolen their identity to obtain loans, that it was all a fake.
This was the end of college for Christopher, perhaps. This was the end of his loans. This was perhaps the end of his being able to afford that fancy Jeep.
To investigators, Christopher's spiraling debt spells one thing: motive.
It was an easy way out, or the only way out for Christopher, in his mind, perhaps, was to kill them.
He and his brother could split the money, sell the house, and he would be able to live the high life. That's what we believed.
A year after the attack, Christopher Porco is indicted for the murder of his father and the attempted murder of his mother. Television reporter Steve Ferentz covers the trial.
he's amazed to see the accused arrive in his beloved Jeep, despite it being a major focus of the prosecution's case.
The yellow Jeep was one of the most visible parts of this trial. And even during the trial, because he was out on bail, he was parking it each day outside the courthouse.
Inside the courthouse, prosecutors lay out their case, peeling back Christopher Porco's mask of lies.
The credit card bills were mounting. The bills for college were mounting. Tens and tens and tens of thousands of dollars of debt seemed to be accruing, and it all came to a head around the time of the murder.
The prosecution's evidence against Christopher is compelling. On the night of November 14th, they say he drives out of the University of Rochester. He pays cash at a toll booth on the way to Del Mar and leaves a trace.
They retrieved his mitochondrial DNA from a toll booth ticket.
Just after 2 a.m., he parks in the driveway of his parents' home, takes an axe from the garage, and uses a spare key to enter their home.
They floated the idea to the jury that Christopher, who worked in a veterinarian's office, that perhaps he had worn his veterinarian's protective clothing to protect himself from any blood spatter.
Christopher types in the security code before smashing the alarm. Then, prosecutors believe, he goes upstairs.
The biggest question that was always left hanging was who could do this to their parents?
But there's one big problem with the prosecution's case. The only eyewitness, Joan Porco, says Christopher didn't do it.
That's when she decides to stand by her son in public and walks side by side with him at the courthouse as everyone gets the first glimpse of her injuries.
While Joan's scars have endured, her memories of that night have not.
She claims, still to this day, that she has no memory of the attack whatsoever.
Joan claims on the witness stand her son is innocent. Will the jury believe her or the evidence?
She wrote a letter to the newspaper defending her son and declaring that he would be incapable of such a heinous act and criticizing the police for doing this. And so her support of him was clearly unwavering.
But against a cascade of damning evidence, Joan's testimony doesn't stand a chance. The jury finds Christopher Porco guilty on both murder and attempted murder charges. For Detective Christopher Bowdish, the verdict is vindication.
I would say that he was probably the most dangerous person I had ever met in my career.
Even after the conviction, many find it hard to fathom how Christopher could so coldly attack his parents with an axe. There are indications that the answer lies deep within his psyche. Some believe Christopher fits the psychological profile of that most dangerous of criminals, the sociopath.
There was one conversation that did come up in court where Peter was quoted as saying to a coworker, "I think my son is a sociopath."
I can tell you this, that a large segment of the community and the law enforcement community are convinced that Christopher shows all the characteristics of a sociopath. His lack of remorse, his failure to accept, and he shows no emotion at all, and really didn't throughout all of this. He just sat back and said nothing, and that bothered people.
In December 2006, Porco is sentenced to 50 years in prison.
The interesting part that will always stick with me, at the end of this trial, after Christopher is found guilty, we file all our news reports, and time passes, the parking lot empties, there's no one left. except for a yellow Jeep in the center of the parking lot.
With his mask of lies finally ripped asunder, Christopher Porco's dreams of grandeur, like his Jeep, are permanently abandoned. I've seen imposters like Mr. Porco infiltrating society soirees, from the Upper East Side to Down Under.
Australia, a nation of glittering opportunity, and never more so than in the late 1990s. Cash registers are ringing. Prosperity is peaking. The land down under is on the way out. And keeping the economy moving is Bernie Whelan.
Bernie was a self-made man. He had risen to become the CEO of a large forklift manufacturing company.
Bernie's forklifts are shifting all those products Australians want. And they come in handy when delivering his paychecks, too.
They lived on a huge property on the outskirts of Sydney. They had horses, they had tennis courts, they had a pool. Life was fantastic for them.
Bernie and his wife, Carrie, like nothing more than sharing their wealth with friends.
They would often have people coming to their property to play tennis in their tennis courts. They were a very affluent, socially successful and popular couple.
But in the fall of 1997, a shadow falls over the Whelans' perfect life.
She loved clothes and fashion, and she always looked very vivacious and very glamorous.
It's the morning of May 6th, and Carrie has special reason to be dressing up.
Bernie was going to Adelaide for business, and Carrie was travelling with Bernie to Adelaide to have a weekend at the wineries in the Barossa Valley.
Not wanting to pack her expensive jewellery in her luggage, Carrie decides to wear it.
And I'll see you around about 4 o'clock.
The couple agrees to meet later at Bernie's office.
Before he left for work, he kissed his wife goodbye. He told Carrie not to be late.
At 5:30 p.m., Carrie's flight from Sydney Airport departs for Adelaide. But she and Bernie aren't on it. According to her husband, she never meets him at work.
It was just a mystery. She had just disappeared, and that was just so out of character.
She was a great older sister and just a very devoted mother. Gregarious, very popular, and very capable.
Brett Ryan is Carrie's brother. The news he receives that day takes him by surprise.
I got a call that night saying that Carrie was missing, which seemed very odd. It wasn't just a missed appointment.
Had Carrie met with foul play? Perhaps because of her fondness for flashy jewellery.
She was wearing $50,000 worth of jewellery at the time. The biggest fear was that she had been attacked for her handbag, for her jewellery, and for her money.
The mystery deepens when Carrie's car is found abandoned in a parking lot beneath a luxury hotel.
We drove down to Bernie and Carrie's house. A lot of the family had gathered there. That day in the early afternoon is when we received the ransom note.
The letter opened with the words, "There will be no second chances. Follow all instructions or your wife will die."
You don't reach the top of the corporate ladder without knowing how to strike a deal. Establish a good price and the profits pour in. But there's one thing Bernie Whelan never expected to be bargaining over: the fate of his own wife.
Inside the envelope was a two-page letter, and it was demanding $1 million for Kerry's safe return. It also included a demand that he not involve the police.
If he did, Kerry would die.
There's a big problem with that last demand. Sydney police had already been alerted to Carrie's disappearance the day before. Leading the investigation is Detective Sergeant Dennis Bray.
The indications in the note indicated that it was an international group, that they'd done kidnappings before.
It appears if he ever wants to see his wife again, Bernie has to act fast.
The ransom letter said Bernie had 7 days to get the money. He then had to place a cryptic advertisement in the public notice section of a major Sydney newspaper. The kidnapper then would make further contact with how the money would be delivered.
For most, coming up with $1 million cash in a week would be out of the question. But not for high-flying CEO Bernie Whelan.
Bernie's company had a procedure for ransom demands of this kind. The company immediately organised the transfer of $1 million to be delivered to Bernie's house. It was placed in a green trash bag and put into a safe waiting for the kidnapper to make further contact.
While they await that contact, the Whelan's Kurrajong property swarms with cops.
They were armed with semi-automatic weapons, with grenades, with tear gas. There were snipers. It was just a huge police operation.
But after 7 days, there's nothing.
There was no reaction. There was no response from the kidnapper.
Which makes some wonder if there is a kidnapper at all. Could Bernie Whelan have staged this farce for his own gain?
Bernie was a suspect. He was questioned at length over many hours by detectives to see whether he had been involved. How happy was their marriage? Were either of them having an affair?
What about Carrie herself? She's 20 years younger than her husband. Did she have another lover and a reason to disappear?
They also, very seriously, looked at the possibility that Kerry may have staged her own disappearance. Did she have a boyfriend that she'd run off with?
How are you?
I'm good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And it turns out Kerry has been spending time with a mystery man.
Amanda, the nanny who lived there, remembered that 2 weeks beforehand there had been an unexpected and unusual visitor to the house.
Carrie's son also recalls seeing the visitor.
At the end of the visit, which took about half an hour, this man went and kissed Carrie on the cheek goodbye and then left the property. After he'd left, Carrie said some rather strange things about this man.
She turned to Amanda and said, "Don't tell anybody he was here." She then said, "Don't worry, I'm not having an affair."
Could this unknown stranger hold the key to where Kerry is?
This nanny couldn't remember the name of this man, but she went through some photograph albums and she was able to point out a man who had previously been to the Whelans' home on a tennis day as being that man who'd come to visit Kerry on that day.
Have you met Luke?
No, I think so. Bruce Burrell?
Good to have Bruce. Yeah.
The man was identified as Bruce Burrell, an old family friend. And when Bernie was told about this, Bernie was surprised and said, "Bruce, he's like a teddy bear."
8 years earlier, Bernie had been Bruce Burrell's boss. They'd also socialized together at Bernie's home.
Good friends.
Good friends.
Mr. Whelan had employed Bruce back in 89 as an advertising executive for the company. End of the downturn in the industry, Mr. Whelan decided to retrench that position.
But Bernie hasn't seen Bruce in years. What was Bruce doing with Bernie's wife? And where is she now? After 2 weeks, with still no contact from the kidnappers or Kerry, police decide it's time for the husband to go public.
You can start when you're ready, sir.
I've been asked to make a public statement regarding the kidnapping of my wife, Kerry Whelan.
Mr. Whelan did a public appeal asking for the kidnappers to make contact and the safe return of his wife.
Kerry, if you can hear what I'm saying, I want you to know that we all love you. We will do anything to get you back. But most of all, don't give up.
Bernie Whelan appears distraught, but there's speculation about whether his emotion is genuine.
When a woman disappears and she's married, experience shows that the husband is often the person who's responsible for the disappearance.
Police retrace Carrie's last moments.
I'll see you about 4 o'clock.
She'd left home just after 8 a.m. after saying goodbye to her husband. She's supposed to meet him at 4 p.m. at his office to go to the airport, but she's never seen again until police seize the camera from the hotel parking lot.
She was captured on security surveillance camera at the Park Royal Hotel. She had parked her vehicle in the car park and she was seen walking up the ramp, and then she vanished.
Carrie had mentioned to her husband she had a beautician's appointment at 9:30. But police find out there was no such appointment. Where was Carrie headed when she disappeared?
In her diary, she had just written the words 9:30. That was it.
Police turn their attention to family friend, Bruce Burrell.
He liked to talk himself up as a big advertising executive who drove a sports car, who owned many properties, and was very wealthy.
Cops want to know why this wealthy country gent paid a visit to Carrie 2 weeks before she disappeared. Bruce says he'd been at a shooting range nearby and decided to drop in. But police find out that's a lie. And Burrell has no solid alibi for the time Carrie disappeared. Is he trying to hide something? If so, he's got the perfect place to do it. His 500-acre property, Hillydale.
It had 300 mine shafts. It had vast areas of dense bushland, wooded areas, ravines, caves.
2 weeks after Carrie disappeared, police swoop onto Burrell's property. They hope to find Carrie still alive.
For 5 days, they scoured that property.
Bruce Burrell maintains his innocence. And as the police search continues, he holds a press conference on his property.
The last 5 days for me have been, to say the least, a bit of a living hell.
Can Bruce Burrell categorically deny he was involved in Carrie Whelan's disappearance?
I can say that absolutely categorically. I'm disappointed when people ask that question, but I understand it's a question that's got to be asked given the circumstances.
As the search carries on, the case takes an unexpected turn. At Bernie Whelan's workplace, a call is received.
Do you ever want to see Carrie?
The caller indicated that it was a kidnapper, and to tell Mr. Whelan to get the police and media away. His wife is alive and will be in contact within 2 weeks.
In Sydney, Australia, wealthy 39-year-old mother of three, Carrie Whelan, is missing, believed kidnapped. Police scour the rural property of a family friend, Bruce Burrell. And there's a breakthrough.
During the massive police search that was underway, the kidnapper finally made contact. He phoned Bernie's office and said, if you ever want to see Carrie again, call off the police and media immediately.
Call off the search now.
Is the call a hoax or genuine contact from the kidnappers? Police can't be sure. Meanwhile, their search of Bruce Burrell's property has turned up no sign of Carrie.
What they did find was a lot of firearms, ammunition. They found an empty bottle of chloroform and some stolen vehicles.
One of those stolen cars is a two-tone SUV. While Bruce Burrell claims he has no idea where Carrie Whelan is, this car will tell a different story.
In the early stages of the investigation, the CCTV footage from the Park Royal was obtained.
A camera in the parking lot shows Kerry walking up the ramp. Then, 40 seconds later, another camera in the hotel captures something intriguing.
Well, the glass door inside the Park Royal was picking up the reflection of what was happening on the street. It picked up an image of a two-door Pajero.
Bruce Burrell owned a green SUV that matched the description captured in the camera footage.
When the police realised that Kerry Whelan must have got into this two-tone, two-door Pajero, of course, the conjecture was, well, why?
Is Kerry having an affair with Bruce Burrell? Cops delve into Bruce Burrell's past and find he's not all he seems.
He drove a sports car, he owned two properties, he had a country estate, but it was all a facade. Bruce Burrell was on the brink of bankruptcy.
Since he lost his job with Bernie Whelan's company, Bruce had been cultivating alternative sources of income.
He had approached many older women, a number of older women, for money. One of them in particular had given him $100,000. That woman was Dorothy Davis.
Bruce says he looked after Dorothy's money as a favor.
Dorothy Davis had disappeared off the face of the earth 2 years before Kerry Whelan's disappearance.
Two missing women, both connected to Bruce Burrell. On national TV, he says it's a tragic coincidence.
It doesn't look good without doubt, but because I've known them, doesn't mean I've had an involvement.
Police don't buy that. In 2006, Burrell faces trial for Kerry Whelan's murder. Partly because they don't have a body, it has taken 9 years for prosecutors to assemble a case against Burrell.
It was a very long road to justice.
New South Wales senior Crown prosecutor Mark Tedeschi is the man tasked with bringing Kerry's killer to justice. He and Kerry's family believe there was no affair between Bruce and Kerry. Instead, Bruce had created a ruse to lure Kerry to meet him.
I'm convinced that Kerry thought that she was meeting Bruce Burrell at the Park Royal Hotel to go and see Bernie so that Bruce Burrell could ask Bernie to pass some work to him. And I think that he'd given her some sob story about being in desperate financial straits, and she, in her kindness, had agreed to assist him.
Hi.
Hey, Kerry.
Ready to go?
Yeah, I've been.
How are you?
Bruce tells Kerry to keep the visit a secret so the pair can surprise his old friend Bernie.
At some stage in that journey, Bruce Burrell stopped his four-wheel drive Pajero and turned what was a voluntary lift into an abduction. In my view, he used that chloroform to subdue her.
No one knows whether Kerry dies now or later.
He was always going to murder her. I mean, he could never have kidnapped her and let her go because she knew him.
The next day, Kerry's husband receives a ransom note written by Bruce Burrell. Perhaps because police get involved, Burrell's not bold enough to try to claim the ransom money. He decides to cut his losses and conceal the evidence of his crime.
It would have been very easy to dispose of a body in one of these mine shafts, cave in the shaft, and it would never, ever be found.
When police search his property, he panics and makes a phone call from a booth to warn them off.
At the trial, we could prove that that call must have been made by Bruce Burrell.
Hello?
If you ever want to see Kerry alive, call off the search now.
Two documents found at Burrell's property clinch the case.
One of the dot point notes was an early outline of the whole kidnapping plan. The other dot point note was an early outline of the ransom note. And if you put the two of them together, you could almost kind of follow the ransom note, and it followed these two dot point notes almost word for word.
It's believed the crime was motivated purely by Bruce's lack of money.
He was on the brink of bankruptcy. He hadn't worked in 7 years, and the only way out was money. The only way to get it was to kill.
Over 9 years after Carrie Whelan disappeared, Bruce Burrell is convicted of her murder.
He was sentenced to life, and life meaning life, as in never to be released.
Bruce Burrell is also later convicted of the murder of Dorothy Davis and receives a sentence of 28 years.
Dottie Davis wanted her money back, and there was no way that Bruce could pay her the money. So the easiest way was to get rid of Dottie Davis. So he killed her as well, and it's likely Dottie and Kerry have been buried in the same spot. Bruce had also boasted to friends, including Bernie, that he had a hiding spot where he could hide bodies that nobody would ever find.
To this day, Burrell refuses to admit his guilt or say what he did with his victims' bodies.
To grieve, you need a funeral, and we've never had that. So the grieving is this slow, drip-feeding process, and that's a terrible, terrible way to lose someone.
Even after Burrell's conviction, Bernie Whelan is still willing to pay to get his wife back. He posts a $50,000 reward for anyone who can locate Kerry's body. But the offer expires, and Kerry Whelan's final resting place remains a mystery. Bruce Burrell's greed held rich women to ransom, and Christopher Porco thought an axe could solve his financial woes. They paraded among the wealthy like devils in the skies, hiding their naked lust for riches behind a mask of lies. Till next time we meet behind mansion walls, I'm Christopher Mason.